ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
People who, it's not just a caravan, they'll be coming to ask, there'll be a family with a couple of small kids and asking, can they just set up a tent anywhere on our property just to live, just to have something so they are not sleeping in a car so they can actually accommodate their kids.
Caravan park owners say they are copping the brunt of the housing crisis as those on the brink of homelessness turn to these facilities as a last resort. We'll have that story soon. And a community radio station in Alice Springs is becoming a breeding ground for new diverse voices by giving people with disability a platform to broadcast.
It makes me feel like I'm able to achieve something and prove to people that people with disabilities actually have a chance in this world to show them what it means to blossom like a flower.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. Caravan park owners in WA Southwest say they are copping the brunt of the housing crisis as people desperate for a roof over their heads turn to these parks as a last resort. Owners have spoken to the ABC about the emotional toll of having to turn desperate people away. Madigan Landry has the story.
Greg Homer has owned the Waterloo Village Caravan Park in Bunbury, about 170 kilometres south of Perth, for 14 years. He says the housing crisis has changed his business dramatically.
Our phone does not stop ringing every single day. More and more people who are seeking accommodation that they can actually afford, which brings them to caravan parks. We tend to be the most affordable of all styles of accommodation. I would say, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20 phone calls a day where there are people who are looking for places to stay. We people showing up. I mean, we've had people in tears at our front counter, people who come back multiple times a day, people who, it's not just a caravan, they'll be coming to ask, there'll be a family with a couple of small kids and asking, can they just set up a tent anywhere on our property just to live, just to have something so they are not sleeping in a car so they can actually accommodate their kids. Yeah, very, very tough to face that. And to be honest, we are not able to help nearly as many people as what we'd like. Now, it's very rare that somebody decides to give up their accommodation and move out. I don't think I've had a vacancy at the caravan park now for probably 4 to 5 months.
Kylie Holt has spent the last 5 years living in a converted 1967 Leyland Leopard school bus in a caravan park in the state's southwest. She says she's seen an increase in the number of people using caravan parks as long-term accommodation.
I'd say where we are, the amount of permanent families and people that we had has probably doubled in the last 3 years where we've been. And that ranges from young mums with children, older men who have come out of divorced or widowed, and they can't afford a mortgage on their pension. And, yeah, we're all reliant on having somewhere to call home, no matter how humble that becomes. And it's just trying to provide that stability for yourself and your family. Look, I'm reminded every week of how lucky I am. I've got quite a few, and I deal with the homeless on and off all during the week. And we've often joked about how much they would love to have a caravan or something that they could live in and just call their own. So I remember very regularly how lucky I am.
Mark Glasson is the CEO of Anglicare WA. He says even caravan park space has been exhausted by the prolonged housing shortage.
What we're seeing that caravan parks are becoming increasingly inaccessible. What we're seeing now is the costs of housing generally are putting more pressure on. So I would agree with the caravan park owners. But the inaccessibility of caravan parks for many people means that they are sleeping rough. They're sleeping in their cars, in tents, in people's backyards. For us, there's a worrying trend that what was an emergency valve is no longer available. The experience of caravan park owners and people being unable to access caravan parks and other affordable accommodation is directly related to the bigger housing system. This is a symptom, not a cause.
Anglicare CEO Mark Glasson Ending that report by Madigan Landry.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And staying with the issue of housing, have you ever seen a house arrive in five pieces? In Central Australia, a new kind of home, designed with and for local families, has rolled into Tennant Creek, a small remote town 500 kilometres north of Alice Springs. The one-of-a-kind home is prefabricated in Adelaide, then in five separate parts trucked up the Stuart Highway through the Northern Territory. It's the first of a series of community-designed prefabricated houses from Aboriginal-led group Wilya Junta. ABC Alice Springs journalist Chris Murakarani Fitzpatrick was there to see it.
Five trucks, each carrying a slice of home, roll up the Stuart Highway on their way to Tennant Creek. On the roadside, Warramungu traditional owner Norman Frank and his partner and designer Serena Morton wave as the modules glide past. Serena says she's waited 5 years for this moment.
Right now, I just can't wait to see my house. We was waiting for this, and now finally we're waiting to see it going past through here.
Norman Frank founded Wilya Junta after years of overcrowding and sickness in his town. He hopes that these homes will help his people live better lives.
Well, that's what we like to see in the whole Northern Territory, our whole country. Hope, you know, our people don't suffer that like we already suffering, living in these houses now and getting sick because of, you know, heart rates, everything for young people, because of overcrowding. Well, we've got mother-in-laws and father-in-laws and son-in-laws. And that's why we need to live a bit properly with space that we can get around.
Wilya Junta calls this an explain home. It's a culture-first prefab, co-designed in Tennant Creek for how families there actually live. Think of wide shaded breezeways, two verandas to create a space for women and men, two bathrooms for cultural avoidance, an outdoor kitchen for hunting and big cook-ups, with wider doorways and flatter access for elders and people with disabilities. Overcrowding in the Barkly region has been linked to infectious disease and acute rheumatic fever in kids. The aim is simple. More usable cool rooms inside and big shaded space outside, so visitors for footy, culture and funerals don't pack into a hot box. Chief Operations Officer of Wilya Junta, Dr. Simon Quilty, says the build is cost competitive with standard anti-public housing and cheaper to run over the long term.
Out here, particularly in summer, it gets very hot, and if you don't have a well thermally designed house, it can get hotter on the inside than the out. And that's the problem with the current rollout of houses in remote communities. They are very poorly thermally performing, and so people have to spend a lot of money on air conditioning. This house has had input from CSIRO and some of the best architects and engineers in Australia to get it exactly right in a way that's scalable and very cost competitive with what the government's currently spending on houses. The upfront costs is about the same, but the long-term savings are extraordinary. We are very confident that these houses will solve lots of the problems of overcrowding, lots of the health issues like rheumatic heart disease and infectious diseases like COVID and scabies, diseases that are really rife in remote communities. And they cost the taxpayer a lot of money through aeromedical evacuations of sick people, through very complex disease, and more than that, they're devastating for families when young children get something like acute rheumatic fever.
The house is first made in Adelaide, South Australia, before it's trucked over 1,000 kilometres to Tennant Creek. There, once on site, it's bolted together in just a matter of hours. Afterwards, it's connected to utilities such as electricity and plumbing, and reinforced with mud bricking to increase its insulation. On the roof, solar, backed by batteries. The plan is to link future homes into local energy systems to cut bills and to keep the aircon on when the heat is extreme.
This technology is available. It will save the families that live in those houses huge power bills. It will allow them to buy healthier food and to have more fuel for their car to travel and all of those kind of things that every Australian takes for granted. And those costs in remote communities are really amplified.
It fits a broader shift across Australia, where First Nations groups are pairing housing and community-controlled power, solar and battery, microgrids. Last year, the small Enti community of Malinja, near Elliot in the Barkly, switched on an Indigenous-owned microgrid that connects every household. Residents reported bills down by 70%. Chantel Johns, the community liaison officer for Original Power and resident of Malinja, says the microgrid transformed her home.
It's already saving us money, like on our bills and that. So, but before that, it was changing people's lives by being able to be involved in a project, get employment, get training and all of that. And plus, after all of this too, we are like establishing our own community cooperative. So that's going to be like more opportunities for people to grow.
Original Power is partnering on the solar and battery systems for Wilya Junta's homes, and staff hope a local microgrid could be in Tennant Creek's future too.
We still want to live our way in our country, and we try to make a house that can fit in our own country and our climate. Because our climate, it's changing these days. And now these houses that we live in now today, that built nearly 40 years ago, that we're living in the township, it's starting to burn, be cold in winter. So we want something that can, mix into our climate.
That story from Alice Springs journalist Chris Murikarani Fitzpatrick, who was in Tennant Creek. A hidden crisis is unfolding in Australia's flagship Pacific Development Program, known as the PALM Scheme, with workers leaving their Australian employers, which some say are abusive and exploitative. Some of these workers are now undocumented, unemployed and homeless, and many are now finding refuge in rural communities around Australia. Lucy Cooper has the story.
I was left with nothing.
It was supposed to be an opportunity to save money for school and support her family in the Solomon Islands. But instead, Susan Pinu found herself in dire circumstances.
I feel like sad.
She came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM Scheme, which aims to address labour shortages in rural and regional Australia. It's often described as a win-win, filling jobs in agriculture, meat processing and aged care, while providing income for Timorese and Pacific Islanders. But the scheme has been criticised for putting its participants in danger of exploitation. For Susan, work was inconsistent. She moved to 4 states in just 9 months, and her take-home pay was too low because of excessive deductions.
If someone like big fast, they're gonna get everything, but if you pick slow, you have nothing. Like sometimes we're gonna left with $100, $200.
Susan left her employer, a labour hire company, and she's not alone. More than 7,000 PALM Scheme workers have disengaged in the 5 years since 2019, a decision which puts some of them in breach of their visa conditions.
We heard all kinds of stories from people who'd left the PALM Scheme, some really harrowing accounts of, abuse and exploitation.
Dr. Kaya Barry is from Griffith University. She's among researchers from 3 universities who have put out a new report looking at the work and living conditions of disengaged workers.
We saw several payslips that people showed us where they'd receive like zero take-home pay, like zero net pay. They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery. So they have no legal status in Australia. That means they have no support for Medicare, for work cover, for any kinds of rights that everybody else here, either on a temporary visa or an Australian citizen, has.
She said PALM Scheme workers arrive with visas tying them to one employer, and they face barriers to changing jobs if they encounter problems at work.
A lot of the workers that we've spoken to have felt that they were just unable to ask for changes, whether that's changes just to the role or the kind of work they're doing, or changes to their location in where they work.
One former PALM worker, Wayne Levy, left his employer, a labour hire company, over concerns about excessive deductions and low pay.
There is no transparency regarding our payment. We don't know what's going on. All the deduction, we don't know what we deducted for. At the end of the day, I just received, let's say, $200 and $300. So I can't support my family. I have kids back home and they have to attend their education, and I have to plan, I have to meet for the future. So when I receive this sum of money, you know, it's like a pain in my body.
He's since gained a bridging visa, which allows him to work on a citrus farm.
See, this is a good opportunity. I come and show the citrus farm. Yeah, it's a good money here.
He ended up in the New South Wales riverina town of Leeton.
I love Leeton. I want to stay here for the whole of, for the whole of my life. If I can get my family here too, it would be great, yeah.
The sun-drenched horticultural hub is home to fruit and rice-growing industries that fill supermarket shelves across Australia. It's here that community leaders have seen an influx of workers looking to make ends meet.
People aren't becoming disengaged here in Leeton. They're disengaged before they come to Leeton. So they come here seeking friendship, connections.
Paul Matem leads the town's multicultural support group. He also served as the local mayor for 16 years.
We can't walk away when we see people that maybe haven't been treated fairly. They don't really know where to go. They're frightened. They don't have any real connection, so we fill that gap.
He was pivotal in creating the reputation Leeton has today, one of acceptance and safety.
We don't have a brick wall around our town, and we never will. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home.
Do you get paid for the work that you do?
No.
Why do you do it?
Well, in a nutshell, I care.
Susan Pienaar didn't return home after leaving the PALM scheme. Her family needed financial support and she feared violence from someone she knew back home. She too found herself in Leeton after forming a relationship with a former PALM worker and falling pregnant. Soon after giving birth to her daughter Angela, there was a breakdown in the relationship.
In that time, like, after everything, I feel like commit suicide.
She found support from a Leeton family who gave her accommodation and community workers who helped her obtain a bridging visa, letting her study aged and disability care.
That's comfort bring me, like, I'm someone.
Paul Matem said many former PALM workers who are pregnant go months without medical care.
The worst case I've seen is one woman 8 months pregnant that's never been to a doctor, remembering they've got no health cover. They've got nothing there to give them any cover, so they just turn up.
Leeton Mayor George Weston is proud of the culture Leeton has, but warns everything has a tipping point.
We go out our way to try and help these people. It's not a burden. It can be a burden if it left for go too long. If more and more people come here, we need really help from the federal government.
That's Leeton Mayor George Weston, ending that report from Lucy Cooper.
In a moment of weakness, I said, yeah, sure, let's do 70.
ABC Australia Wide.
To the far west of New South Wales now. Broken Hill's hard rock geology could be part of the solution to Australia's energy storage problem as the country shifts to renewables. Canadian company Hydrostore is planning to build a 200 megawatt compressed air energy storage project capable of powering about 80,000 homes for a day. So what is compressed air energy? Our reporter Catherine Spackman has taken a look.
The far west of New South Wales has solar farms and solar panels, but nowhere to store large amounts of excess renewable energy. It's estimated Australia will need up to 20 times more energy storage by 2050. Canadian company Hydrostore believes Broken Hill's hard rock is part of the solution. It's planning to build a 200 megawatt compressed air energy storage facility capable of powering up to 80,000 homes a day. CSIRO's Ben Clennell, who has worked for Hydrostore in the past, says compressed air energy is not a new technology.
It's a bit like storing air in a compressed air cylinder that's used to power air tools. It's the same principle, but instead of being on a small scale and powering, you know, a drill or some device like that, it's actually for regenerating electricity that is being stored from times when that electricity is abundant and then being used when it's required at a different time of day.
Hydrostore's Martin Becker says it plans to excavate a 280,000 cubic metre cavern about 600 metres underground.
The reason we're in Broken Hill, well, one of the reasons we're in Broken Hill is the rock is very hard and, you know, is basically, it will hold water and air without having to line it or build a steel vessel. So, because it's, you know, very high density rock. So we will just, all we need is space to store the appropriate, you know, amount of air and water, depending on the state of charge of the facility. So we will just be basically building out a cavern using the natural formation of the rock, and that will become the lining, if you like. We do not have to line the cavern at all because the rock's, you know, it's not going to leak.
The air is kept pressurised underground with a water reservoir. Dr. Clennell says the process is known as hydrostatic compensation.
As the air goes into the underground cavern, it pushes water out of the cavern to lake at the top. As the air is drawn out to generate power, the water from that lake goes down again and fills the space, and that keeps the pressure constant during the process. That's called hydrostatic compensation.
Once the air is back on the surface, it is reheated using heat saved during the initial compression stage. Hydrostore's Martin Becker says it makes the system more efficient than traditional compressed air storage systems.
So in traditional compressed air, when the air is reused to generate, they normally use natural gas to heat it. So that is very inefficient because, you know, you're introducing not only another fuel source, but then a fossil fuel source. So by capturing that heat, storing it and re-injecting it, you're eliminating the need to introduce another fuel.
Overall, the system has a round-trip efficiency of about 66%. This means about two-thirds of the electricity used to power the air compressors is later recovered as electricity generated by the turbines. Professor Graham Nathan from the Heavy Industry Low Carbon Transition Cooperative Research Centre says compressed air energy is not as efficient as other storage, but it has its advantages.
The compression and the turbine processes themselves have a fair amount of loss in them because you're compressing air or using air turbines, just as with steam turbines. They're generally less efficient than using pumps. You're inherently going to be limited to some extent by the efficiency of the system, but by the same token, you know, they're reliable and they can do large amounts of energy storage. Yeah, I mean, for example, batteries would be more efficient, but they'd be much higher cost and you wouldn't be able to get stuff of that size without being much, much more expensive.
The compressed air energy storage system can hold about 8 hours of power, which is twice the amount that large grid-scale batteries can hold. Professor Seamus Garvey from the University of Nottingham recently set up the Medium Energy Storage Alliance to help raise awareness for the need of projects like compressed air energy storage.
Most of the action that happens with energy storage, or will happen in the future when we are using energy storage to match up the supply of electricity from renewables with the demand for electricity, most of that action happens in a medium size set of time durations, like between 4 hours and 200 hours. And at the moment, there is some but not enough recognition that medium duration energy storage is something distinct from either long duration storage, which is fuels, or short duration storage, which is managed mostly by batteries.
According to the CSIRO, Australia needs about 10 to 20 times more energy storage of all kinds by 2050 to meet its net zero emissions target. CSIRO's Ben Clennell says compressed air energy storage is part of the solution.
We do see it as a very important element of energy storage technology in the future because it's got fairly well-established and proven underpinnings in the technologies that it uses, and it's making use of the subsurface, which is able to store a large amount of energy, both in terms of compressed air and heat. It's something which we think is important for the future.
That's Ben Clennell, ending that report by Catherine Spackman in Broken Hill. And finally here on Australia Wide, many voices, one frequency. That's the motto of just one of Australia's 450 community radio stations. 8CCC Radio has been filling the airwaves in Alice Springs for more than 40 years. In recent times, it's been committed to giving a voice to people who you wouldn't traditionally hear on a radio station. Elsie Lang has the story.
All right, guys, come with me. Now we're ready for Arvos with Andy.
Powered by a legion of loving volunteers, across Australia, community radio stations act as hubs of culture and connection, reflecting the diversity of the communities they serve. At ACCC Radio in Alice Springs, the voices of people with disabilities are put centre stage, or desk, and broadcast onto the FM airwaves, blasting into local kitchens or cars and online all over the world.
Hey there, guys, and welcome to another exciting afternoon of Jaden's Rock Nation with me, your host, Jaden Stanson. From the Beach Boys' original drummer, Dennis Wilson, which is called River Song, and here it comes.
ACCC sits unassuming next to the local fish and chippy and a Chinese restaurant with a coffee shop out the front and a place to sit and listen. The station brings people of all abilities and backgrounds together to share music and stories. A few years ago, the Outback Station became a National Disability Insurance Scheme training provider, and since that time, it has grown the number of shows presented by people with disability on the station to 5. So what is community radio? Operated by and for local communities, these stations exist all over the country and are integral not only to the ecosystem of media in Australia, but to the arts too.
Yeah, I feel blessed every day to work with the 18,000 volunteers and about 1,000 staff that make up the Australian community radio sector.
That's Rhys Kinnane, the Director of Public Affairs at the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.
We came together as the entire community broadcasting sector 2 years ago and put together a plan, and it really is to focus on what makes community radio unique and different, and that is having diversity of Australian voices heard. It's really important that people with a disability hear stories told with a lens of lived experience. A lot of stations are stepping up to do that.
Andy Harrison lives with a physical disability and has been presenting on ACCC for 5 years. He now presents the afternoon program every weekday and is known for his tough interview style and love of country music.
Me being an ambassador for disability like I am, it gave me the opportunity to put the word out to other young people and say, hey, if you want to get your own show started, come on ACCC and we'll train you up and get your own show going. And now we've got up to 4 or 5 broadcasters with disabilities running on ACCC 5 days a week. This station is for everyone. It doesn't matter whether you've got a disability or not.
Mr. Harrison said it was station manager Benjamin Aaron who offered him a paid full-time role at the station after years of volunteering had honed his skills.
So yeah, ACCC's vision is many voices, one frequency. And it's really this idea that the media and content we create reflects the diversity of voices within our community. But we really became an NDIS support service by accident, and it was from a really passionate volunteer, Andrew Harrison, who knocked on the door one day. He was being supported at the time by Bindi, who recognised he had a voice and had things to say. So Andrew started doing one program a week, and slowly we grew that to 2, we grew that to 3. So we became a support service and built a structure around mentoring and providing professional development for Andy. Being accessible to Andy opened up the door for us being accessible to the broader community because it gave us a landing pad to meet interests from interviews from all sorts of different people, sports, community events, local artists. So it's actually being accessible ourselves has opened us to be accessible to the broader community.
There are a bunch of different shows too. While Mr. Harrison's program welcomes a diverse range of guests, including local musicians and politicians, Ben Russell, who is vision impaired, hosts an hour-long show talking about anime.
It makes me feel like I'm able to achieve something and prove to people that people with disabilities actually have a chance in this world to show them what it means to blossom like a flower.
Jaden Stanton said he felt like a kid in a candy store when he chose the rock music he was going to blast into the world that week for his show, Jaden's Rock Nation. Right now, his show is focused on rock music from the 1970s, and he said he loved interviewing local musicians on air.
Hey there, guys, and welcome to another exciting afternoon of Jaden's Rock Nation with me, your host, Jaden Stanton. And on today's show, we have even more 70s rock with music from Kiss, Rod Stewart, Deep Purple and Aerosmith.
back in the day when I was at Centralian, I actually used to do a little bit of work experience out at Sun 969. I remember that the first time that I went on there, I actually got all this warm praise from like some of my old teachers and whatnot. So, well, one thing I love about ACCC is that it's quite a very good radio station, and plus I'm actually part of the gang now. So, I just want to give a shout out to all of my rock loving brothers and sisters out there who actually love to tune into my show every week.
And how good is community radio?
Oh, we love community radio.
That's the rock loving Jaden Stanton, ending that story by Alice Springs reporter Elsie Lang. And that is Australia Wide for this week. A big thank you to Lisa Herbert for production duties. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.